From the heart of the Kootenays, this is the Friends of Kootenay Lake podcast series, Voices of the Lake.
A podcast that takes deep dives into the world of conservation and field technology to explore some of the coolest and wildest projects taking place locally, and to meet the people who make it happen.
We're your hosts, me, Camille LeBlanc,
and Kayla Tillipaw,
broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Tanaha, Snaiks, Shwetmik, and Silts First Nations. In this episode, we're joined by the fabulous Kat McGlynn, who is a seasoned wildlife technician currently working with the Provincial Ministry of Forest, Lands, Natural Resource Operations, and Rural Development. Kat's experience working with wildlife has taken her across the province on some really wild and interesting adventures, like traversing riverscapes, snorkel swimming down rivers, tracking wildlife by canoe and snowshoe, and trekking through vast wetlands.
Kat tells us about her experiences restoring salmonid habitats on the coast, surveying Slocan River fish populations, analyzing river otter consumption habits in the Slocan, monitoring and conserving northern leopard frogs in the Creston Valley, and mitigating roadkill mortality of western toads at Summit Lake. Kat explains the importance of stewarding amphibians and offers helpful tips on how we can support amphibians and reptiles in our own backyards. This episode provides a glimpse into the life of the workhorses of the environmental field, the technicians who put in the hard labor in all weather conditions, doing the hands-on work and collecting the data that is vital to any conservation initiative.
This fun and energetic episode will shine light on local conservation action in the Kootenays and equip listeners with helpful resources so you can take part.
You're listening to Water Rolls by Born on a Wednesday, which is part of their brand new album, From the Headwaters. Check them out on Facebook, Instagram, Spotify, Bandcamp, Apple Music, iTunes, Amazon, and Pandora at Born on a Wednesday. Thank you for another amazing submission. We seriously love your stuff, and we're so happy to promote local artists. We invite all local musicians to submit music, so hit up our website to apply.
Thanks so much for joining us, Kat. We're really excited to talk to you about some of the cool work you're doing around Kootenay Lake and in my favorite places to hang out, which are wetlands.
Thank you both for having me. I'm really excited.
Awesome. So we always ask this question to our guests. It's kind of like a getting to know you question. What was your last experience or adventure on or around Kootenay Lake?
Good one. This year's been quite busy with not a lot of time for extra recreation. But I guess my most recent memorable moment around Kootenay Lake was that this July, my father passed, and my family is back in Ontario. And sort of due to circumstances, including COVID-related things, I wasn't able to make it back to be with my family. But my mom was able to come out for a visit in September. And my dad just absolutely loved that I lived in the Kootenay region, absolutely loved Kootenay Lake. Whenever they used to come out, they would camp at a number of different campsites all around Kootenay Lake and Nelson. And he just had a deep fondness for just how vast and different it was, the landscape to their urban living in Ontario. And so my mom and I were able to, we were like, what's something really special that we could do? So we just decided that we would go to a couple of his favorite little spots that he thought were magnificent that he'd always bring up in conversation, like traveling across the Kootenay Lake Ferry or even just the Big Orange Bridge. You know, he's always like, how's Bob doing out there? You know, on the phone. So yeah, we just took some time in late September and walked across the bridge together, and we're able to sprinkle some ashes into Kootenay Lake from the bridge. And then also just took a trip over to Crawford Bay to have lunch at the Black Salt Cafe, one of my favorites. And en route across the ferry, we were able to sprinkle some of those ashes off the ferry. So just meant a lot for us just to be able to, you know, that was somewhere he'd want to travel to. So there he is. That was one of my most memorable experiences on Kootenai Lake this year.
Oh, that's so beautiful and so touching. And Kat, my condolences for your loss, but you know, you guys did something so special for him. And wherever he is, I'm sure he was just smiling. And his smile will be reflected in the sparkles of Kootenai Lake forever. So that's very, so special.
Thanks so much. Yeah. Oh, it was awesome.
It's awesome.
So, Kat, would you tell us a little bit about yourself and the work that you do?
Sure. So I've lived in the Kootenai region for the last 9 years, and I currently work as a wildlife technician for the Forest Lands Natural Resource Operations and Rural Development Ministry through the sort of special section Fish and Wildlife Compensation Program. And I have a varied role as a technician with FLNRO, but my primary role over the last few years has been the field coordinator for the Northern Leopard Frog Program. And yeah, I'm just excited to be chatting with you today about my love for amphibian conservation.
That's so cool. How did you end up in this role? It sounds like such a great opportunity, but like maybe presenting some interesting challenges. So how'd you get there?
Yeah, it was interesting. It was sort of in a roundabout way. I got my experience in applied biology when I moved to Iqaluit in 2008, on the west coast of Vancouver Island. And I had just finished university in Ontario and, you know, was busy at that time guiding outdoor experiences for different organizations like Outward Bound Canada and a bunch of guiding outfits, dog sledding, whitewater canoeing. Spent about 4 years tree planting, or 5 years tree planting, and a couple summers doing forest firefighting, and just was looking for something different. So headed out west and fell in love with the coastal life, and ended up getting a job with a really cool organization called Central West Coast Forest Society. And they specialize in stream and riparian salmonid habitat restoration. And it kind of just like blew my mind, kind of going into areas that had been impacted primarily by historical logging, and just learning to see the landscape like a fish would want to, and going in and sort of altering or restoring and enhancing. And that was sort of just where I got my feet wet in the world of fish and wildlife field studies. And so that's where it all kind of started. And then moving to the Kootenais, you know, it was tough to find work because we're so lucky to have Selkirk College and so many keen and smart humans all vying for any field work positions.
Yeah, I can relate.
Yeah,
a dream opportunity. But yeah, so I kind of like, I started by just volunteering for every organization. I felt really lucky that Slocan Valley Stream Keepers allowed me to volunteer on a number of projects and introduced me to the Columbia Basin Watershed Network and the work they were doing. And they were having a big water conference, and I just got really excited about conservation in the Kootenais as I was growing to love the landscape here. So that's sort of where it started. And then I just stuck my thumb into every pie possible and finally was able to find a position with the Fish and Wildlife Comp with the Ministry of Forest.
Yeah. Wow. You sound like someone who would be like willing to like try anything and just, and just really put yourself out there and learn as you go. So I think that is just so cool. Some of that experience sounds so rich and so diverse.
When it comes to field stuff, I say yes to pretty much everything and whether I regretted it after or not. But it was really cool because one of my first and most memorable jobs when I first got here was the opportunity to snorkel swim the Slocan River for some fish studies that were happening there. And yeah, that was just like the perfect combination of all of my interests at the time, you know, from having experience in guiding whitewater canoe trips and having my swiftwater rescue. And then had just come from 6 years of working for the forest organization on the coast doing fish habitat work. And then just being a fish in the slow canoe.
Can you explain like a bit about how that works? Like I don't know my way around a snorkel very well. I can't imagine going underwater with it, but I'd really like to know more about that. Like, what's involved, maybe a little bit more about what that study's for. Yeah,
sure. Yeah. So one of my first positions when I arrived before I was involved with the Ministry of Forest was for a local fish biologist named Pete Corbett. And he's just an incredibly skilled and intelligent human. And he just believed in me. He was like, oh, I've never snorkel swam before. Well, let's get you on the river. And I just dry suit, snorkel and mask. And essentially, like, the goal of snorkel swimming is like an intimate view to kind of monitor fish populations, mostly to document fish abundance or distribution in a system, different age classes that are utilizing the habitat to assess what's happening there and where we're seeing fish selecting. Is there valuable habitat there? And so, pretty intimate way to see the river, but essentially we were working on teams of at most five swimmers, and we'd start the morning with sort of like calibrating turbidity. So getting our understanding of our best visibility from left to right as we would be floating down the river, how far we should be separated in order to get sort of accurate counts. And we'd spend, you know, 4 or 5 hours just checking in. We'd go down sections sort of as one, get down to, you know, a few hundred meters and like check in to make sure everybody was good. And that we felt like we were able to capture counts adequately and accurately. And it was like, it was challenging and incredible and a great team exercise. And it was a really, really cool way for me to understand hydrology of systems. I've been canoeing. We've all floated the slow can. If you live in the Kootenai region at least once in our lives, I think, I hope.
Yeah.
but this was like, you know, your senses were all calmed and you were just experiencing the river as it moves you up and around substrate or large boulders. You just, you're kind of like carving through it. It kind of almost felt like space at times because your ears were covered and you're just paying attention to what you're looking at and potential obstacles in front of you so you can make good judgment calls about safety. And it's just a real incredible experience. Swimming in a pool of fish just doing their thing, stacking up in areas where, you know, like the bottom of a riffle or around log jams. It was just one of my favorite experiences I've ever had.
No kidding. That sounds like a personal dream job of mine. Like, do they take volunteers?
It's for one of those things where maybe if you, got your swiftwater rescue tech, your certification and for sure.
That's so cool. And what time of year were you doing this in? Was water cold or is this in the summer?
Well, it's interesting because being submerged, I mean, I was wearing a dry suit and I also oftentimes had like a fleece or long john layer underneath. Mm. But after 4 to 5 hours, I would still come out with, you know, slightly purple lips. And it regularly occurred in the 3 years I was doing it in late August, early September.
And the slow cam doesn't get very warm. Like, I went floating this year and it was like supposed to be the peak heat of the summer and it was like freezing cold. So it's unpredictable, but
I mean, the way rivers should be is to retain a certain cooler temperature for fish. So
yes,
that gives me comfort.
I love that imagery of like just being a fish essentially with, you know, all of our gear to make us be comfortable as a fish. I know that when we float the river, I get a little squirrely in my floaty. So I get out and I swim, and it's so fun to be pushed by the current and to like mm-hmm. fight against it and feel that power, but actually like getting down in there with the fish and experiencing, you know, the habitat firsthand is, I think, such a great way to like fully understand what is needed in like a river ecosystem mm-hmm. for fish habitat. So that yeah. sounds like an amazing experience.
Mm-hmm. It's true. It was like, it wasn't really until I saw it in action. You know, you learn about it, you read about it in textbooks about the complexity of river habitats and mm-hmm. you know, what fish are looking for, but watching them interact naturally without, you know, there was that time, say a white fish, I had a school of white fish. They get quite scared and, you know, they just get spooked easily. Mm-hmm, so right. as you're swimming by, you kind of interrupt the natural goings on. But say like a large rainbow trout sitting in a mm-hmm. log jam, like deep down, they have like, you know, darker color to them. Like you can almost barely see, they're like a shadow, and they're just, there's this calm, cool movement to them. It's just really, really incredible. And they're not as spooked by you. So you can just sort of hover for a second to make sure, you know, typically that would be so that you can make sure that you counted everybody mm-hmm. In that little section. But, you know, I was going into like a rushing set below Lemon Creek, and all of a sudden this turtle just flashed at the backside Whoa. Of its shell. And Whoa. We both went through what they call the thowag, or the middle of the flow of yeah. the section. And yeah. I was just like, look at this guy. Like his shell is just like the open bottom of a boat just getting flushed downstream. And he just navigated it and went into the next eddy. Whoa. And I was like, wow, I've never seen that before. That was incredible.
What an experience. That's yeah. so cool.
Yeah. Just a turtle just getting in the gnar.
Just riding the wave, you know? Yeah.
It's just like Finding Nemo, like those like, yeah, totally. Surfer turtles.
Right. Except he's so, you know, painted turtles, even as an adult, aren't their shells that's are great. Not that big.
Wow. So, yeah,
pretty wild to see him so navigate
cool.
it.
Yeah, that is very cool. I want to know about another really interesting and wild and cool job that you took on that I read on your LinkedIn, which is river otter scat surveys on the Slocan. So I guess this is basically like a otter poop scavenger hunt that you got paid to do. I want to know more about this. Like, what is this for? What did you yeah. end up finding? Yeah, tell us about this. It's cool.
So it was really sort of based on an interest in otter ecology and how they were selecting prey along the Slocan. There was very little known about how they were interacting, but there was, you know, some sort of old lore that otters, you know, select for rainbow trout, and that could be a reason why that fishery was in decline. Mm. You know, over predation of rainbow trout. And so there was a Selkirk student, a now local technician, master's candidate, Rhea McKenzie, who applied for some funding through the Slocan River Stream Keepers to do an assessment, just to kind of follow the life cycle of the otter through the spring, summer, and winter months, you know, to collect a bunch of scat samples and to better understand their sort of prey drive and what they were selecting for. So we had an opportunity to, by foot, by canoe, by snowshoe, follow a transect from, again, just below Lemon Creek all the way down to Crescent Valley. Mm. And yeah, our treasure was scat samples from all over the river. We were also taking notes about habitat that they frequented, how they were utilizing the habitat in that season. Was it a lower denning site, like a natal denning site, or was it higher up in the spring? And and then we would take those scat samples, and we spent months in a lab in Winlaw just combing through scat, which is funny because my nickname in Ucluelet for a while was Scat McGlynn because I worked on another scat analysis project for the Pacific Rim National Park Reserve. So it was just fitting that I was sitting there slumped over a chair and a microscope combing through scat samples. So
that is such a funny image. I love that. How do you, so you visually could tell what they had been eating, or did you like have to like DNA sample? Like, how did you know what these otter were eating?
Yeah, it's, you know, sometimes people do the isotope studies in DNA, which is more deep laboratory based, but this was like a desktop way of doing scat analysis, in that the process would be that the, you know, all the data information that was connected to that one scat would be retained for that one scat. That scat is kept separate, it's washed, it's dried, and then we tray it. And on the tray, we're spreading out what you'd see. So I can describe it via podcast, is you would see a clump of dark matter that was full of bones, teeth, like bone shards, more like, right, after it's been broken down and digested. Bone shards, teeth, feathers, scales, you know, unknown. And sometimes there was hair found in the samples as well.
Wow.
And so then you sort of, the way I would break up my sample is like put like with like, so that I was able to kind of break down, because really what we were looking for is a really rough overview of what and who they were eating, so that we could look at that over a seasonal review, so that we could understand, you know, sort of come up with the top four prey sources that they were preying on. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so we can look at it as a seasonal diet. And yeah, cool. So it appears that they're more, you know, opportunistic consumers within that system, rather than, you know, selecting specifically for certain species.
Right.
It was interesting to find some marten hair in their scat.
That's crazy. And,
yeah. So, sometimes small fleshy, but they're also pretty combative on the landscape, right, with other species that might be trying to utilize their resources. And then, yeah, so then primarily we found them selecting for fish species, broke the fish species down by taking closer looks at the scales and the counts, and we were able to get it down to species. And Castomidae, or, you know, large scale suckers, ended up being the primary prey source, which makes a lot of sense, because Slocan River is full of rafts of beautiful iridescent purple suckers. And we know that from our fish swims. We were able to overlap it with some of our fish data.
Right.
And they're also slower when they raft up, and there's many at the same time. So if an opportunistic carnivore was diving in, they probably would always come up with a sucker if, you know,
right,
when they were hunting. So
can you explain what you mean by like raft up?
Oh, like when certain species of fish tend to move in groups. And I guess when I use the raft imagery, it's because watching them while snorkel swimming that river, like they, you know, there's many age classes all converging, power in numbers, as they're a little bit slow moving bottom feeders. And so when I say raft, it's like, you know, there was at times I could count 90 to 100 suckers all moving as one, you know, in those sections of the river.
Crazy.
So. Mm-hmm. Oh,
neat.
So, yeah. So I could see why, you know, the otters were selecting large rafts of them, because they probably were almost always successful.
Yeah, I have a better bet.
Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting too. One other memory I have from that experience was that, you know, especially in winter when we were traveling down, being able to see, like, you know, it was very intimate because it, you know, winter's such a time where things all slow down and you're more sort of attuned. It's less busy out there, but being able to see like bevies of tundra swans along the river, or the amount of wolf activity. You know, at one point we hopped out of the canoe on the side of the river. This is winter, so seeing lots of track activity, and then, you know, blasts of tundra swan feathers, you know, with blood splatter on the side of the river, and then noticing paw prints and following them and kind of assessing the gait and noticing that they were quite large. It was a large gait, and coming up on what we saw to be a latrine, or essentially like otters will choose feeding spots. They'll choose defecating locations. And sometimes those are overlapping with den den holes. Mm-hmm. And so there'll be like multiple scats around the hole, or even secretions that they use for scent marking. And we just saw, we wouldn't have found the hole if it wasn't for these tracks, these canine tracks going right to the, to a little den, and it pulled all the way open and back. And there was like a swan kill in behind. Like, it was just like, wow, such an alive moment, you know,
totally.
We're like looking around over our shoulders. Like, it looked fairly fresh, like in the last,
wow,
3 days. So, yeah. Watching how the wolf was interacting potentially with a den site, or at least a living area, and obviously high trafficked by an otter or two.
Yeah.
And yeah, anyways, just a cool.
That's so cool.
Yeah. It was just more just like a narrative, like a story that happens whether we're there or not, but getting a glimpse at it, I thought was like really cool.
Yeah. That is so cool.
That's really, really cool. So you have so much experience like with all these different kinds of wildlife, you know, in aquatic ecosystems. But it seems like more of your focus now is on amphibian species. And I wanted to hear more about your current role, you know, being the field coordinator for the Northern Leopard Frog Project in Creston.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, luckily within the program, I get an opportunity to work on a few different amphibian projects. But since 2017, started working more with the Northern Leopard Frog Project or Recovery in Creston, and stepped into that coordinator position in the spring of 2020, which was an interesting time just with the state of the world and COVID. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of adaptation that needed to happen for our field program. But I have come to love working with amphibians and spend most of April to October either freezing cold or sweating in wading boots, sort of assessing habitat and, as I say, just looking for frogs. It's funny because every year people are like, oh, are you back counting frogs? And I'm like, yep, back count frogs. It's not simple. Obviously, the project is a little more complex than that. But yeah, so with that project, the field component, we're just looking to kind of follow the life cycle of the Northern Leopard Frog. And obviously, just to backtrack, they were once super abundant throughout southeastern BC and the Okanagan. Mm. But obviously, along with many other species, suffered deep declines over the last 30 years. And so they were placed on the endangered species list federally and red listed as an endangered and threatened species provincially. So now they exist just in a small number as a single native population in Creston Valley. So it's our last Northern Leopard Frog population in BC as of right now.
I didn't realize it was that small. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the population is, it's been noted in decline in Alberta and in Saskatchewan, but, you know, there's other provinces that have a more stable population of Northern Leopard Frogs, but obviously there's some genetic difference between location to location as they adapt to the local area. So, so it's very interesting. I mean, Creston is an immense, beautiful wetland ecosystem, so...
Yes.
If I were a Northern Leopard Frog, that's where I would be.
Yes.
And so we just want to maintain that. But back to sort of the field project that I work with is that we're sort of studying their life cycle and their habitat needs. So in spring is an active time for amphibians to be migrating to good quality breeding habitat. And so that often looks like shallow open water pools or pools with emergent vegetation. And so we have sort of a conservation team of technicians, typically, you know, 4 to 6 technicians that have quite a bit of experience, and our jobs to be on site during the prime breeding season, both to assess known breeding areas and to also assess other areas outside of that area in valuable habitat to see if any breeding is occurring in those areas. So the easiest way to do that is to sort of follow the sound of male calling throughout the wetland. Mm. They're out there working their butts off, advertisement calling, you know, look at me, I'm over here, great habitat, strong male. Let's
get what more could you want?
Yeah, what more could you want?
This is a northern leopard frog call.
Yeah, so they're advertising for ripe females to come into the area that they're advertising from. And this is typically in that we're also tracking when we start hearing more vigorous calling. When we first start hearing callers in the wetland, and then also when we start hearing the vigorous, more intense calling, so larger groups of males sort of congregating in one area with lots of like deep, thick, loud, I mean, loud for a northern leopard frog because they have quite a mild call in the wetland. Mm. But we're trying to document and better understand that. Is it becoming earlier as temperatures are changing and we're losing snow and ice off areas earlier in the season, or is it later that year for an additional reason? We're sort of tracking that understanding as well. And so, yeah, like the more practical field-based technicians are heading out at night when nocturnal calling is at its peak, and we set up listening stations so that it's very systematic in our way that we're capturing that data. And we sort of triangulate the calling and map it out so that we have an understanding of a search area for the diurnal or daytime surveying the next day. Mm. And so the crew heads back out the next day, and we sort of grid survey those certain areas very gingerly. Obviously it's a species at risk. And we have our protocol for when we find an egg mass. We sort of do like a really calm hands in the air, butt wiggling dance. Like you want it to be your day to find an egg mass.
Can picture that.
You know, there's some like air high fives all around, and we're just, And then we calmly start taking our data based on that. And then another conservation measure that was put in about 7 years ago was to utilize predation exclusion cages. So for an egg mass that we call a good candidate, so an egg mass that looks like it would be easily moved without impacting its safety and or development, we're able to kind of position it enclosed in this cage, and that way it just gives it that extra opportunity of success and minimize that early stage mortality due to impacts such as wind and predation and that sort of thing. So
give them a chance to develop.
Before they, and it's usually like we'll do a release. We obviously do a lot of caretaking once an egg mass is in a enclosure cage. And I mean, it's not a lot of hands-on, it's very visual. Anyways, we allow them to grow to at least sort of just over a centimeter in size before, you know, re-releasing them into the big city of the complex wetland. So they also, by being in the predation cages, it also allows us to have a population that can be utilized for the potential of translocation studies. Mm-hmm. And also we have access to potential tadpoles to bring into captive reassurance populations with some of our partner organizations, such as the Calgary Zoo's Wilder Institute, and also the Vancouver Aquarium, who are sort of partners in the recovery of the northern leopard frog.
They're doing
captive reassurance research and release as well.
So, do you know where they're releasing them?
Well, right now we've had one reintroduction site that we've been continuing to utilize, and we're just in the process of a large habitat suitability modeling index that will allow us to deeply research 1 to 2 other sites. Mm. And yeah, so that's sort of in the works, and fingers crossed that we'll have some really good data that comes out of both the desktop and the ground truthing exercise that are sort of pairing with that HSI next year.
Yeah, fingers are crossed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that would be really, that is the next step for recovery, is being able to have a stable population in another area. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of groundwork that needs to be, so that is the right action.
Of course, because it's just, there would be so much that would go into that, since exactly. Like habitat selection and habitat values, like it's so specific.
And because we have decreased wetland habitat to choose from because of the habitat loss and degradation of wetlands,
yeah.
there's not as many systems that are like, that have all of the qualitative habitat values that we want to be putting this at-risk population. And so I really appreciate how selective they're being
mm-hmm.
with that research. So another reason why we sort of pinpoint that breeding time to count egg masses, that it is a tool to estimate annual reproductive effort of northern leopard frog, which is exciting because this year was our second highest in the whole stretch of this project. So we
really
were able to observe 31 healthy egg masses within the Crescent Valley.
Oh, that's great.
Hopefully this is a rise in the trajectory.
Yeah. This project, like, it's so rewarding. And like, I don't know, you must like, or I hope you take moments every now and then to reflect on like how cool it is that you get to spend so much time with like this species that pretty much no one else in the province will ever really get to see unless they go to Crescent. So that's so neat.
I've just been learning a lot from this species and just amphibians in general. You know, I think as kids, you're catching frogs in ditches and like building castles for, well, maybe it was just me, but like, you know, building these little dream locations for them. And then, that's oftentimes kind of our intro into like conservation or compassion for wildlife. That was my experience as a kid. But then, yeah, to kind of lose sight and be focusing on more like apex predators and like the, you know, the interesting, you know, big carnivores. And then to go back down to kind of that really micro mm-hmm. perspective of looking at the complexity of wetlands and then these small little amphibian beings there. It's just, it's pretty humbling. And just being out on that wetland landscape in the Crescent Valley is just exceptional. Sunsets are incredible. But
some of the photos you've shared on social media, like I follow you, of course, and they're just beautiful. You get to getting to see like wetlands at different times of the day too, it's just really mm-hmm. great. You probably have a lot of those awe moments.
Yeah, definitely. I don't take it for granted. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, like our perspective and the way we spend time in the wetlands sort of changes within the summer season. Because then we're just sort of, we're still trekking around doing surveys, but we're more tracking like development of the young a year and looking at the hydrologic changes within the breeding areas and or the travel corridors that they're moving into. So like sort of just assuring that water levels are consistent enough for metamorphosis to occur. Metamorphosis is the development from tadpole or the aquatic dependent state to a young of year, which is what we call them when they begin to explore and forage for nutrients more terrestrially or on land. And then August, we shift our focus to observing how they're moving from that summer foraging into those breeding areas. And I sort of spoke to that in the amphibians presentation that I did for you guys mm-hmm. a couple months ago. But just that they're seeking sort of old river canals or creeks and streams with springs, things that have access to, you know, dissolved oxygen levels that will allow them to sort of hunker down for the winter, but still have access to be able to breathe through the winter months while they sort of shut their systems down to kind of go into torpor, that state of hibernation. So
mm-hmm.
in that time, we're capturing them more, we're capturing and handling them more. And we're sort of taking those growth metrics, looking for signs of disease and injury. And then of course, taking photos and scanning them for the mark recapture program. Yeah, right. And then I spend my winter doing data entry and analysis.
Just presenting
our findings. Yeah.
That's how we were able to get you for this call. That's so interesting. So for those who are maybe hearing all this work you're doing all throughout the year, some people might be wondering, like, why is this work being done? Why is there a concern or a need for data on amphibians and other wetland species?
That's a good question. I mean, one, we should understand changes that are occurring, and also if the chance to lose any species is probably pretty important to get down to the bottom line about. But I mean, for amphibian studies in general, I mean, their eggs and their skin are just so highly permeable. So, you know, in order to allow oxygen and water to pass through. So the combination of those characteristics makes them especially vulnerable to changes in habitat quality, as well as pollutants. So they're kind of like canaries in the coal mine, so to speak, you know, certain ecosystems. Yeah. And they also influence populations, as the tadpoles are primary consumers, and whatever is occurring at that stage is rippling up the chain. So pretty important to be able to see if there's drastic changes. And like within that, they're threatened by absolutely everything, but like current research is sort of pointing at climate change and habitat loss, sort of ranking among those sort of most devastating to them. But you know, there's like competition with other species, pollution, disease, predation, UV radiation, you know, it's like the combination of all these stressors that's contributing to this worldwide decline of amphibians. So pretty important to understand what's happening with our local populations.
Yeah. And to have data to back up that need for conservation is so important.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I remember before I even got into the environmental field, like I happened upon an article which explained how amphibians can absorb like remnants of antibiotics and birth control and pharmaceutical drugs that end up in the waterways that people consume and then is released through excrement, and how it can't be filtered out. And, you know, that really opened my eyes, like from the beginning, just how sensitive they are, and how it really helps for us to just know about their various sensitivities and threats. Because, you know, just knowledge is the first step, and then knowing what to do comes out of that.
Yeah.
Could you briefly like let our audience know what amphibian species are native to our region, to the Kootenai region?
Yeah, for sure. Amphibian species native to the Kootenai region. We've got the Pacific chorus frog, the Columbia spotted frog, the long-toed salamander, and western toads, as well as the Coeur d'Alene salamander that can be found closer to the border near Creston, not in necessarily in large numbers. And obviously the northern leopard frog that we were speaking about, that is isolated to that Creston Valley Wildlife Management Area. The Pacific chorus frogs are those most vocal frogs that we would hear in a movie, potentially in a wetland scene, or, you know, like at night with an element of silence, you might hear a frog calling in the background, most likely a chorus frog. They ranged from like that taupey beige color to that bright green, almost tropical looking color. They're quite a small frog. The Columbia spotted frogs are the frogs that I get a lot of calls about. People believing that they have a northern leopard frog in their backyard or in their local pond. Those Columbia spotted frogs, they're a very idyllic looking frog that's a little more muted in color than the northern leopard frog or the Pacific chorus frog, but quite average size. Long-toed salamanders, obviously they look like small little dragons with a nice bright yellow stripe, a squiggly stripe down their back from just between their eyes to their tail. And we don't often see those in adult life stage unless you've just by accident came upon one, flipped over a rock or an old rotting piece of wood. But we see them, we get an opportunity to see them a lot in their larval stage in the wetlands. Definitely Google long-toed salamander larvae and you are looking at a mini dragon. They're pretty amazing.
Cool.
And then the western toads, which we're pretty synonymous with here in the Kootenays. If kids or families have been to our Toad Fest event up at Summit Lake, they're pretty special amphibians because they live such a terrestrial life. So sometimes you'll be on a hike in the high alpine and you'll come across one. So
Yes, yeah. we're so very familiar with Western toads now, working on our Harrop Wetland Restoration Project.
Exactly.
And speaking of Western toads and Summit Lake, we're curious to know a little bit about the work that you've been part of doing road mortality mitigation for Western toads. It is for Western toads, yes?
It is, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of other species that benefit from it as well.
Yeah, but, yeah, of course.
The focus is on Western toads up on that project. Yeah, there's a few road mortality mitigation projects going around throughout BC, actually, some really successful ones, and lucky to have some keen groups interested in the mitigation work as well, like the Valhalla Wilderness Society up at Fish Lake. If people have seen that rest area conservation effort that they've put a lot of work into.
It's beautiful. And,
yeah, the Summit Lake project. I mean, I'm a technician on that project, and I work under a few really awesome wildlife biologists that have been studying there for the last, 10 to 12 years. And yeah, I mean, it's pretty important area. There's some special things about Summit Lake, a higher elevation lake that's quite shallow and warm. Mm-hmm. With incredible upland habitat all around. The mm-hmm. only challenge is that intersecting highway.
Yes.
It really impacted that population with the amount of mortality that was being experienced along that highway section. So yeah, it's shown to have cumulative effects on Western toad abundance up there. So when mm-hmm. research started happening, they were able to start surveying the highway during peak movement times in the life cycle of Western toads during their migration times. And yeah, they really started studying and keying in and collecting reliable systematic data for that project. So they could truly understand the impacts and allow them to understand those hot spots in order to generate some strategies to minimize the impacts. And so what started happening is, they were able to either retrofit or install culvert underpasses. And so now there's three that are functioning up along that, I believe it's about like a 3.2 kilometer stretch of highway. And with the culvert infrastructure, we installed what's called wing fencing. So it's essentially fencing that comes out from the sides of the culvert and helps sort of flush the species that are migrating from the lake or to the lake, kind of converges them into the safe underpassage mm-hmm. via the culvert. And so, yeah, it's been very, very, it's a lot of infrastructure to be erected and maintained, but yeah. The project's been pretty vigilant about that. And we're able to update certain sections of the fence to be more permanent and long-term. And we're continuing to still capture data in order to influence other areas that are still being impacted by high areas of mortality. And this year, it's shown great success. We had some support doing a statistical analysis of the data captured, and it was found that the infrastructure at the point it is right now, where we've reinforced all the temporary sections and we know that the culverts are operating correctly, great. We've been able to decrease mortality. We know that now that the infrastructure has done so. So we just hope to continue that effort because of the significance of the Summit Lake population of Western toads.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
So yeah, that's sort of the importance of the road mortality mitigation, is collecting reliable systematic data that can influence really strategic infrastructure efforts and decrease that mortality.
I remember in when I was going to school at Selkirk, one of the lead biologists on the project, I won't name names, but it was one of the lead biologists on the project. He did a presentation and showed the footage from a game cam that was put in one of the culverts.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so cool to see all of the other species that are benefiting from that. Like, I think I remember like skunks, and I think even squirrels, and And then there was like a kid, someone's kid, tripped the camera too. So it was so heartwarming. And I still feel this way. I really wish that like every single highway had that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty, pretty incredible. The folks that have been working on this project for so long, kudos to them. And the camera trapping is what that's called. And that is just like another way to look at usage, mostly to capture the biggest understanding that we're trying to capture there is adult movement, because it was the adult mortality that was, you know, contributing to the deepest decline in the population. Mm-hmm, of course. And then by erecting these structures for adult movement, it is having positive influence on the migrating toadlets as well, that start following similar paths. And this, it was interesting anecdotally working on the project this year, especially during that heat wave, is that we noted that the development and the migration of the toadlets was slightly more punctuated than in previous years, potentially with the a sped up development stage due to the heat.
Interesting.
And we were noting that they were really traveling along the wetted riparian areas of the small creeks. We know from toadlet monitoring that they do utilize those creeks, but it was interesting how they were really sticking to them this year with that.
Staying cool.
Mm-hmm. And that could be something that we look more at as we continue to have changes with climate, and to really watch for those.
This is why
how important riparian areas are.
Yeah, this is why observations and like continual observations over, you know, over many, many years are so important, because you discover things like that and other possible mitigation techniques while you're out there and you're keeping a watchful eye.
Yeah. And I think it's important for people, like that project gets a lot of local support, because people really have been attached to that Summit Lake population for a long time because of the effort of the Fish and Wildlife Comp program and and Toad Fest. And I think it's just like, it's more just like a real beautiful opportunity right now for people to find something that they care about and, you know, just pay close attention to conservation people can do in their own backyards. We can all do our part for the big and the small.
100%.
On a conservation lens.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a perfect segue into the perfect closing, which is, what can people do in their own backyards to protect amphibians?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it all depends on where you're living. You know, there's also our reptilian community that we can find in drier areas. I have an alligator lizard that lives in one of my rocky crops on my property.
Cool.
But also for amphibians, like, yeah, I guess I would just suggest mowing's a big thing, or having sort of rewilding certain parts of your yard, allowing it to find its own beauty rather than getting in there and manicuring. So I like to think like establishing vegetated edges in your in and around your yard, or leaving leaves late in the season for nice cover opportunity for some amphibian species. I always encourage utilizing native plants to enhance your gardens. Contact local community groups such as the Kootenai Native Plant Society or KinSeed for native plant sales. I did that this spring, and I was just like flabbergasted at the amount of information I got from those folks.
Great.
And just keeping, you know, like little rock covers or woody debris piles, even a turned over pot in your garden, a broken old terracotta pot, pop a little door in there and you might find a toad.
That sounds so cute. Weeks,
especially as we're in a housing shortage here in the Kootenai.
Yeah. For amphibians too.
Exactly. Shallow water that might be accessible. I just keep some like pooled buckets and things out. I actually found two things. I had like a pot of basil that I was watering every day, and then for like 2 weeks I had a Pacific chorus frog move in, and I just put a little slanted rock in there, and he literally slept under the slanted rock for like a week.
I was gonna ask how Basil was doing.
Basil, I love that guy. I haven't seen him in a while. I think he's hunkering down, probably closer to the river. And then I just always encourage people to educate themselves about the different species, like check in to recalibrate the color and timing of the different species in your yard or that you come across, because it's just really important. And all those sightings and observations are really valuable. And you can let Friends of Kootenai Lake know about interesting sightings and observations through their website that I'm sure you guys plug all the time. And then also through Frog Watch. And then of course, like making sure if you know the native species, then you'll know when you see something different on the landscape because of the introduction of bullfrogs. Yeah. It's really important for us to be really on top of that. So I think you see anything sort of out of the norm, a large frog in your backyard, then make sure you connect with organizations like CKIS or Front Counter BC, and those that information would come right to someone like myself to follow up on those observations and sightings. So
that's wonderful. Yeah, we'll put links to those resources in our write-up for this episode, as well as a link to our Lake Watchers program where you can enter, you know, any kind of observation, any wildlife observation that you see, and you can even put it on a map so we can know where people are observing these things. And I can credit Kat for that. She brought that idea to us. So thanks so much for helping us shape that program.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's important work that the Focalist is doing for sure.
Thank you so much. Well, this was wonderful. You're so cool. I love how you were able to walk us through all of these adventures that you've taken and all your experience, and, you know, providing some practical actions people can take, and also some more hobbies people can take up when they're floating the Slocan River.
There you go. Yes. Hop out with your snorkeling mask if you're good at swimming.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Know your
abilities is always important. That's so great. Is there anything else you would like our listeners to know? Is there anything else you'd like to add, promote? This is your time. We're going to hand it over to you.
I would just say that I think it's a really important time for us to be contributing to local conservation and or supporting the nonprofits that are doing the outreach work in our communities. And I just am continually thankful for organizations like the Friends of Kootenai Lake, because I think connecting all the dots and asking important questions is really a big piece of progress and continuing conservation and just inspiring people. So I'm just really, really thankful to the Friends of Kootenai Lake for that.
You're too sweet, Kat. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And you played no small part in that, in your time with the organization and helping, you know, build our programs, and you continue to, you know, be so generous with your time, providing, you know, your knowledge in our amphibian citizen science workshops. So we're really grateful to have someone like you so involved.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
Anytime. Thanks so much. Yeah, I guess another great website to keep up to date on the different conservation projects that are happening in the region. I always like to check it out. Always has beautiful photos and updates and results is the FWCP, or the Fish and Wildlife Compensation Program. And that's just fwcp.ca. And I always like to read up about other projects and partnerships that are happening around the Columbia region.
Definitely. Yeah. Thanks for that.
Check it out and get inspired. I love it.
Thanks for tuning in to Voices of the Lake. Stay updated on what we've been up to. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Friends of Kootenai Lake, and check us out on Twitter at FOKL_.
Huge thanks to our funders, the Regional District of Central Kootenai, Nelson District Credit Union, and Fortis BC for helping us bring these stories to you.
Again, you're listening to Water Rolls by Born on a Wednesday. Hear more of their music on Spotify, Bandcamp, Apple Music, iTunes, Amazon, Pandora, or check them out on Facebook and Instagram. Thanks, Born on a Wednesday.